The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. About 16 years ago, Jessica Leahy was a newly minted teacher who discovered that a student had lifted full paragraphs of text off the internet and put them into her school paper. Jessica called the child's mother in to tell her that she'd be initiating disciplinary action. I'll let her pick it up from here. What happened?
Well, I called the mother, and she was concerned, as any mother would be. But more than that, she was upset, and she said, "You can't discipline my child. She didn't write the paper; I did." And which meant not only was she writing her daughter's paper, she was plagiarizing her daughter's work with stuff from the internet. And I'm not really sure how I'm supposed to deal with that as a teacher.
Well, now Jessica Leahy is an educator, speaker, New York Times columnist, and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. She's taking aim at the coddling, competitive helicopter parents who would do just about anything to assure their children's success and minimize their disappointments. Her new book, The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed, draws on her experience and supporting research showing that overprotective parents make for risk-averse, dependent adults. And Jessica, congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks.
Now, in the introduction, you do write, "We have taught our kids to fear failure. How?"
When I first started writing this, I was at first incensed by the overparenting and the coddling and the paving the way. But really what I became more worried about was the effect of that, the effect that kids end up really worried about making mistakes. They're worried about failing. They're worried about anything that's not perfection right off the bat, because they know that as where their parents are concerned and where colleges are concerned, every point counts. And there just isn't room to make mistakes anymore.
Well, you bring us through this historical kind of record of how children were regarded from the they should be seen and not heard in the colonial era. Then we get the parenting experts of the early 20th century and Dr. Spock
right.
in the 1950s. When did children's self-esteem become a motivating force in parenting?
Well, that came in the late 60s, early 70s, when people were working so hard to create this sort of force field of self-esteem around their kids, thinking that if we told them they were wonderful enough that, you know, any insults or injury would, you know, boing off like we had put a protective force field around them. And that's just not it's not how it works. And as many authors have shown, it didn't quite turn out that way. We've set up our kids to feel really, really confident, but not particularly competent. The confidence aspect of things doesn't have anything to do with experience. We don't let our kids have the experience to become competent. And therefore, they end up with these empty shells of, oh, well, my mommy or my daddy thinks I can do this and I'm fantastic. But there's no real experience to back that up.
So the message to kids is you're great, but you also don't know what you're doing? I mean, I don't get it.
You're brilliant, you're talented, you're wonderful, you're creative. And kids walk out into the world thinking that they shouldn't be experiencing any difficulties where these things are concerned. If they're, for example, if they're really great at math from kindergarten on, then, you know, everyone's going to come up against a place in math where it gets hard. You know, I talked with Steven Strogatz, who's a math professor at Cornell, and he says it gets hard for everybody, even, you know, a PhD in math. And so when these kids run up against those difficult moments, they then think, oh, no, I better not tell anyone. I better not show that I have any challenges here. No one's going to think that I'm smart, talented, wonderful, whatever. These labels that we put on kids of gifted, talented, brilliant, you're so wonderful all the time, are as damaging as some of the negative labels that we put on kids.
But like the mother who plagiarized for her daughter, I mean, she's well-intentioned.
Right.
She wants her to do well. And we are in this cutthroat environment, you know, pretty much from the time that kids are toddling to when they do their college SATs and applications, they are in fierce competition
right.
with each other to get placement. So It's pretty hard to drop out of that. You know, if you're just one person, what kind of advice do you have to parents who think, I don't want to be in that rat race anymore? How do I do it?
I really think the best way to approach that is to think long-term instead of short-term. When we're thinking short-term about our parenting, we're thinking about making our kid happy now. If the kid forgets their homework, leaves it at home on the table, and I take it to them today, that will alleviate any suffering they have about the fact that they show up at school without homework today. But it doesn't do anything in terms of their long-term learning, their long-term strategies to prevent forgetting the homework the next time around.
Well, you are talking about a story with your own son. One of your own sons that you knew he'd worked really hard on this homework and he left without it and you had a struggle. Tell me about how you processed that struggle for yourself. How did you keep yourself from acting?
I was in the middle of writing this book, and I went to Facebook, and I said, lest any of you think this is easy for me, just know my kid's homework is sitting on the table right now, and he worked so hard on it, and I have to go to school later on in the day, and it's taking everything in me to not jump in the car with that homework. And I actually had an argument with someone on Facebook about it, but when it came down to it, I realized we had just been having a discussion about putting homework in the backpack for the past 2 weeks, actually, before that. And I knew that if I took that homework, it was going to short circuit any progress we've made towards creating a strategy to get the homework in the backpack and have it make it to school. And in the end, that was true. That day, he had to have a conversation with his teacher, a real sit-down discussion with the teacher about strategy. And he and his teacher came up with a strategy that is something he still uses today, which is an index card on the refrigerator with a checklist of things he needs to do for the day. And that wouldn't have happened if I had taken that homework that day.
That's a lot of restraint, I think, in a case like that. But you, this is something that you talk with a parent about because you're a mother and a teacher.
Right.
So you have a couple of different perspectives on this. And there's a point where a mother comes to you and she says that her daughter just doesn't seem excited about learning anymore. And you say the less we push our kids towards educational success, the more they will learn. Now, how do you back that up?
I back that up with the research on intrinsic motivation. The fantastic and brilliant Edward Deci wrote a book called Why We Do What We Do, The Science of Human Motivation. And for us to find our own interest in what we're doing, for us to find flow, that wonderful thing that Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi talks about, flow, where we're engaged in an activity just for the activity itself, not for some end result we're hoping to get out the other side of it. We have to be autonomous, we have to feel competent, and we have to feel connected both to the activity and to the people around us and know that whatever it is we're doing means something to the world around us. And when we're acting only out of an interest in points, grades, in order to make our mom happy, in order to get approval, that's not where true motivation, where intrinsic motivation comes from. That's not how we achieve real flow with whatever it is we're doing. We can't get there when we're extrinsically motivated, either by our parents or grades or teachers or whatever. And the more I saw my students pushed to do things for the product and not for the process, the more I saw them lose interest in the process. Mm-hmm. And for a teacher, that's a disaster.
We're speaking with Jessica Leahy. She writes the Parent Teacher Conference column for the New York Times, and she's an educator and speaker and now author of The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. Well, that research also built upon some research earlier about rewards. Now, mm-hmm. you're against this. You say ditch the lollipop in your book, against that sort of system of rewards. Tell us more about what is behind that thinking and how we can break ourselves from this. You know, everyone gets a ribbon, even if you're in 13th place.
Right. Anyone who's read Dan Pink's Drive, this will not be news to them. Dan Pink really did an incredible job looking at the science of rewards based on the work of Harry Harlow and Edward Deci. There's a great point to be made that, you know, when the seal trainer runs out of herring, the seal show is over. Something about when we give kids, when we give primates, in the case of Harry Harlow, when we gave them rewards, their interest in doing the thing for the thing itself declined. Rewards seem to mess not only with motivation, but also with creativity.
So one of the suggestions is have kids help out with household chores. Now, why household chores? What does that do for them?
Well, the bigger picture really is to have goals. One of the things that parents ask me a lot about is, okay, well, this is all well and good, but we still have to deal with test scores. We still have to deal with grades. We still have to deal with things like that. And I say, well, let's make home a place where we're more oriented on process instead of product, and we're more oriented towards personal goals. We talk about it a lot in our family, you know, making goals that employ some sort of risk. And one of the things that people tend to focus on when they talk about goals or they talk about rewards is getting money for chores. And that's something that just doesn't seem to work. If you read a book like The Opposite of Spoiled by Ron Lieber, he talks about that in his book as well. And there's something about being a part of a team, being a part of a family, being part of a class that seems to foster motivation. And in our household, we do things for each other and we do things for our household because they're part of our responsibility, not because we're going to get paid for them.
Yeah, but you talk about your inner monologue, what's going on there. It's faster if I just do it by myself. You know, it's going to take so much to teach him. People are going to judge me. My right. house is going to look terrible. You know, my kids are going to look terrible if they're not if they're dressing themselves in right. whatever is on the bed or whatever.
Well, I have two stories from this week. There was crusty dishes that came out of our dishwasher, and those had to be redone, and it led to yet another discussion about why the crusty food was on the plate in the first place. And then we had a load of laundry that had to get done twice in our house because it sat in the dryer all night long, and my husband even tweeted out a lovely picture of my older son sitting next to a pile of laundry on the couch because he was steadfastly avoiding folding it. It's not a process of, okay, I change the way things work in my house and overnight we have success. It's a long-term goals are sort of the name of the game here. My kids have learned how to do stuff and then in that wonderful way teenagers tend to do it, have forgotten how to do laundry or forgotten how to load the dishwasher the right way and have gone to school wearing disgusting dirty clothes or mismatched outfits. But that's all part of this wonderful process of growing up, and far be it from me to remove those moments for them.
Well, you mentioned the moment of risk. How do you distinguish what are the great learning experiences and what is something that could, you know, lead them down the wrong path? I mean, it's, of course, not one action is going to be so deterministic, but what's the right way to point?
I think the hard part is sometimes it's hard to know which moments are going to be going down the wrong path and which moments are going to be great learning experiences until you've seen them out. And I think we've gotten into this trap where we're so worried that every single failure is going to lead to some long-term, this is going to go on your permanent record sort of moment, that we're really afraid to take the leap and take the risk with our kid. And there's a story in the book about a mom whose son really was failing out of school, and the school had decided it was time for him to leave that school and go back to his school district school that was far inferior to the school he'd been attending. And the mother came to him and said, look, we're going to go visit that other school and you're going to have some hard decisions to make. Either you engage or I'm going to let you fail out of this superior school and you're going to have to go back to this other school where you're not going to get as much individual attention. And the son, when faced with that decision and when faced with both realities, made the decision to take control of his own work and his own motivation. And it was a real life-changing decision for him. If she had taken over and written his essays for him or taken over and reminded him every single day to put his homework in his bag, he may still be at that superior school, but he wouldn't have learned anything. And he certainly wouldn't have changed in the huge way that his mother reports he has changed since then.
Well, it takes a huge change in parenting. And I wonder if that is something, you know, when you're looking at the long view, someone can read this book and what kind of small incremental right. changes you might begin.
Right. There's another story where someone was really upset with me for giving her daughter a B-. And I said in our discussion in our parent-teacher conference that was called with myself and my boss and both parents, and it was all very serious because of this B-. And I said at one point, I said, you're going to have to trust me. This B- is going to be one of the best things that ever happened to your daughter. They didn't. In the end, that girl wrote about that B- as being a really important point in her middle school career, a moment when she realized she had to make some decisions about what she valued in herself, the hard work versus the coasting. And you know, in the end, those parents, you know, if they were to have another crisis with their child, who knows if they're going to remember that moment, but their daughter will. And that's what's important to me.
Well, Jessica Leahy, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jessica Leahy is a contributing writer for The New York Times and for The Atlantic. She's author of a new book called The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. There's more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Any parent knows that a kitchen full of hungry kids at supper time can be a recipe for disaster, unless, that is, they're helping to make the meal. Despite the dangers of hot ovens and sharp knives, or perhaps because of them, teaching kids to cook imparts a valuable set of skills, like autonomy and safety, and how to follow directions.
Can I dump it in?
Yep. All right, so dump the rhubarb in. Trevor, get the cup measure.
Which one's the cup measure?
Which one do you think?
That was writer KJ Dell'Antonia, coaching her son and a friend on making strawberry rhubarb ice cream. KJ Dell'Antonia is lead editor and writer behind Motherload. It's the New York Times parenting blog, home of the Kids Cook series. And KJ, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Well, so you've been doing this series with Margot Lasky from New York Times Cooking, alternating posts each week. Now, first, how old are your kids?
I have two 9-year-olds, an 11-year-old, and a 14-year-old. And they've been really pretty much cooking all their lives.
And Margot's daughter is only 3.
Right, and then she has a baby who's just about 1 year. So they cook together, and then the baby, you know, taste tests.
So how, or maybe more importantly, when do you think kids can start helping out in the kitchen?
Well, like Margot, I'd say my kids started at about 3 with me. I might soften butter and give them the butter to put on a garlic toast. So I'd say, you know, here, rub a little bit of garlic on, and now smear the garlic on, and then you sprinkle the Parmesan on, and we put it into the broiler. And that's very exciting because you've actually contributed something to the meal, and it's very simple. And we had a lot of garlic toast. So, you know, pour the pasta into the boiling water. Be careful. Stand back. This is what boiling water looks like. It's kind of amazing how often you need to tell kids things like, this is what the water looks like when it's at a boil. You know, this is what you have to wait for before you put things into the pan. So the sooner you start, even if your child is just standing next to you and maybe doing the bare minimum, the sooner they start to build up that base of knowledge.
What do you think is the value of that base of knowledge?
Oh, we really want our kids to be able to cook for themselves, right? We want them to be able to do it as teenagers when they come home from school. We want them to be able to choose to put together a healthy snack instead of reaching for the first bag of chips that comes out of the pantry. When they move into a dorm, we want them to be able to head over to the dorm kitchen and mix something up if they didn't like what the food was. We want them to move into their first apartments and be able to cook. We do not want them to be like the young Dartmouth babysitter that I once had, and I handed her, you know, a box of macaroni and cheese, and she opened everything and dumped it in the water and then turned on the stove. This is not what you want to raise.
Well, here's a clip of a much more advanced skill set. In this video, you're coaching your 11-year-old daughter, Lily, as she cooks chicken in hot oil. We'll be able to hear she's a little bit nervous.
Hot. Yeah. But you don't have to be perfectly precise.
Okay, is this really popping up at me?
I know. It's all right.
Now, listeners can't see what happens at the end of this video, which is quite cute. After she screams, she makes a kind of giddy little smile and immediately goes back to taking the chicken out of the hot oil.
Hot snapping oil is scary. That's a very funny recipe. It's called ketchup chicken. So I think for her, you know, she'll often make the sauce or she'll often cut the chicken or something like that. But the sautéing, that is nerve-wracking because the oil can be poppy and the sounds are quite dramatic and you kind of have to be fast and you get it all in. But she was really excited to succeed.
Yeah, I love the pride. In fact, I was just looking at Facebook the other day and a friend of mine, Courtney Esbach Wells, her daughter was cooking and her daughter had made brownies. And the quote is, did your mom help you make this? And her daughter says, no, she helped me. a wonderful sense of ownership. But a lot of folks, as I'm guessing that you know from your readers at Motherlode, can be quite judgmental when it comes to raising kids and exposing them to any kind of danger. Do you worry at all that having your kids use knives or hot stoves might attract negative comments?
Well, I feel pretty strongly that it's actually safer to teach them how to do it right than to leave them just to figure it out. One thing that I often tell readers that I have been told as I learned to cook is that it's better to have a really sharp, big knife and learn to use it right than to try to cut something with a teeny-weeny knife that's not sharp enough and you have to saw away at it. You're much more likely to hurt yourself with poor tools and, you know, if you don't understand how to use them.
So that's a good basic. I'm curious about what are some of the good introductory things that Margot's been doing with her three-year-old, for example.
She did a watermelon and tomato salad. She had her daughter, you know, learning to dice with watermelon. She actually has a little tool, which we don't have. It looks kind of like a dough scraper, and her daughter's been using that to slice, and she has one for tomatoes, too. So she has some special stuff that was perhaps not around when my kids were younger, but it's really helping.
You've heard that phrase, you know, cooking is an art, baking is a science. Do you think kids are better suited to learning one of these skills?
I think people really tend to have kids bake. And baking is great. You learn to follow instructions. Baking is, in many ways, a science. If you don't add your baking soda, obviously you're going to get a terrible result. You really need to weigh and get your measurements right if you want a cake. Some things are a little more forgiving. But one of the things that we're trying to do is not to focus on baking and desserts, which are always fun and easy. And, you know, who's not happy to turn out a pan of cookies? We want our kids to be excited to make the salad for dinner. We want them to be excited to work on the main course, because some of the goal here is, you know, not independent brownie making, which you know, we love, but, you know, real independent cooking. And also, there are really three kinds of cooking as we've been thinking about it. There's following the recipe, which is great. You need to be able to do that. There's following our instructions, which is also great. You need a certain basis of knowledge. But then there's that moment when they can walk into the kitchen and, if nothing else, at least make the box of macaroni and cheese all by themselves without any commentary for you. You know when the water is boiling. Know that you have to set the timer and you can't forget about it or you're going to end up with sogginess. Know that you want to put the butter into the hot pan so that it melts before you re-add the pasta. I mean, you know, those all sound dumb and simple, but there actually is a little baseline of knowledge that you have, even to do something as simple as that.
You're doing this in the age of the helicopter parent, you know, those who don't give their kids enough space to work things out for themselves, afraid of any lack of success. Do you think parents today are less likely to let their kids cook than maybe when you were growing up?
Well, I think it's true that, you know, we all cook less, and we often don't think our kids are as capable as they are. If we're cooking less, we also see that as a more unusual activity, something that's more adult, that's more intense, as opposed to just something that sort of naturally happens every day because it has to.
Okay. Do you see a day when the sous chefs are going to take over and you can sit back and let them do it on their own?
Absolutely. I think my 14-year-old could certainly prepare a meal right now. He would probably have questions. There are some things. My 11-year-old could recook that ketchup chicken. She absolutely could. And actually, my 9-year-old daughter made an entire pasta dinner the other day with me, you know, standing over her. I would guess that if we do that, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 more times, she'll be ready. They ought to be able to do it. There's a lot of things that are pretty simple, and we ought to give kids the opportunity to do these things for themselves. And who knows, maybe somebody's going to have pasta with tomatoes for their afternoon snack instead of Doritos.
Okay, we look forward to that. KJ Dell'Antonia, thank you.
Thank you.
KJ Dell'Antonia is the lead editor and writer behind Motherlode. That's the New York Times parenting blog. And you'll find links to read the Kids Cook series and see some of the videos by KJ and Margot Lasky at wordofmouthradio.org. Last month, a lost work by a great American writer was published to critical acclaim. And no, I'm not talking about Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman. I'm referring to What Pet Should I Get? By Theodore Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss.
I took one fast look. I saw a fine dog who shook hands, so we shook. So I said, I want him. But then Kay saw a cat. She gave it a pat, and she said, I want that.
While you're probably familiar with The Lorax or The Cat in the Hat or Green Eggs and Ham and the dozens of other world-famous Seuss books, there is one chapter of Geisel's professional history that remains relatively unknown. Before he was world-famous for his children's books, Dr. Seuss employed his rich imagination and skillful illustrations for another purpose, convincing Americans to go to war.
He was working on the conclusion to a children's book called Horton Hatches the Egg. The date was June 14th, 1940, and he was listening to the radio.
That's Donald Pease, professor of English at Dartmouth College and the Ted and Helen Geisel Professor of the Humanities.
On the radio, he heard news that Hitler's tanks had moved into Paris. And then shortly after that broadcast, he heard Senator Nye from North Dakota urge the United States to maintain a condition of isolationism.
Americans want no more war. Most of all, they want no more participation in foreign wars.
Dr. Pease says that Geisel was enraged by the paradox of those news accounts and shortly thereafter took a job as chief editorial cartoonist for the New York tabloid PM. Over the next few years, he drew more than 400 political cartoons.
He was primarily focused on two figures, Charles Lindbergh at home, who was a famous supporter, or rather infamous supporter, of Nazi Germany and an anti-Semite, and Hitler abroad.
In one of Geisel's cartoons, Lindbergh affectionately pats the head of a long sea serpent, which aside from being adorned with a Hitler mustache and decorative swastikas, could have come straight from the pages of One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish. And Lindbergh is saying in the caption, "'Tis Roosevelt, not Hitler, that the world should really fear."
He created these caricatures rather quickly because he worked by way of the impulse that news of the day had generated. So he worked by way of the anger that incited him to create the caricatures, the invective. He also needed to meet a deadline. So that work, although it bears some rudimentary relation to the later children's books, doesn't have any of the finish or the framing or the wit or the zaniness that's evident in his children's books.
It's a strange experience looking over these cartoons. Seuss's children's books are often described as timeless, but these strips are anything but, and in some cases, classic Seuss characters are presented completely outside of their familiar context. The Republican Party, for example, is represented in Seuss's strips, as in other political cartoons, as an elephant. Only Seuss's GOP pachyderm looks just like the lovable Horton from Horton Hears a Who.
I meant what I said, and I said what I meant. And an elephant's faithful, 100%.
After Pearl Harbor, he turned to Japanese civilians as well as citizens as a target for his caricatures. And some of the caricatures were quite stereotyped and vicious.
Attention, please. This film, now released for public showing, has been captured from the enemy. It is a typical example of vicious Japanese propaganda.
This series of cartoons also looks vaguely familiar, but in the worst sort of way, like the infamous 1943 Bugs Bunny animated short Tokyo Jokyo or Popeye's You're a Sap, Mr. Jap. Seuss used racist epithets and exaggerated features during this period to vilify Japanese forces and even encourage suspicion of Japanese Americans here in the United States.
But he nevertheless deeply regretted having constructed those caricatures. And as he would explain when he released Horton Hears a Who for publication, the refrain, "A person is a person, no matter how small," was one effort at apologizing to the Japanese people for the demonizing caricatures he'd constructed of them during the war.
Seuss So what led Theodore Geisel to turn his back on political polemics in favor of Grinches, green eggs, and truffula trees? The answer, Donald Pease says, goes all the way back to Geisel's childhood, when, ironically, he was bullied for his German ancestry.
When he and his sister, Marnie, were walking back and forth from school on Mulberry Street and would be accosted, the year is 1915, by fellow students who would scream, "Let's kill the Kaiser's kid. Let's get the drunken Hun." After the war, he began to understand that the disposition he had internalized to create those cartoons had actually turned him into a mirror image of those boys who had hit him with brick bats when he was a little boy. He was now the bearer of the bricks rather than the target.
It wasn't until 1947 that Seuss got back to writing children's books, but over the next 20 years, he went on to produce The Cat in the Hat, One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish, and What Pet Should I Get?, which was discovered in a box and recently published. While some of these stories fall into the category of pure whimsy, others clearly connect Geisel's days as a political cartoonist and his work as children's author Dr. Seuss.
It isn't that he wanted to sacrifice the political import of his cartoons. He couldn't if he wanted to get the war mentality out of the next generation. He wanted instead to foster the love of equality, the desire for peace, a world in which human beings could be in relation to one another, the sense that they were celebrating jointly their freedom.
Sadly, Dr. Seuss's hopes of ending partisanship and mutual antagonism hasn't exactly panned out. After his book The Lorax was adapted into an animated feature in 2012, Lou Dobbs of Fox News lambasted the film as anti-business propaganda.
The movie, set to be released nationwide next month, is about a woodland creature who speaks for the trees and fights rampant industrialism. So where have we all heard this before? Occupy Wall Street.
That reaction led Comedy Central's Funny or Die to produce an animated short called The Conservative Lorax.
Now, I am the Lorax, and I speak for free markets. So why are you making the need industry targets?
I'm trying to take care of the truffle trees.
For now, Seuss's newly discovered, posthumously published work, What Pet Should I Get?, does not seem to be drawing any fire. But who knows? Animal lovers can be a pretty passionate group. A big thanks to Dr. Seuss expert Donald Pease for speaking with us for this story. Pease is professor of English at Dartmouth College and the Ted and Helen Geisel Professor of the Humanities. You can see examples of Dr. Seuss's political cartoons at wordofmouthradio.org. And now to a story of a man who played a pivotal role in one of the most beloved children's movies of all time, but kept his involvement secret for most of his life. By the end of his 25-year military career, Donnie Dunnigan was a highly decorated major who received two awards for valor in combat as well as a Purple Heart. He says the Marines were a perfect fit for him, as long as no one found out about his past. He and his wife Dana sat down for StoryCorps.
I got a draft notice in 1952. Korean War still going on, and I'm going to do my duty. I think I had 13 promotions in 21 years. As I remember, it was a Marine Corps record at the time.
Did anyone know that you were the voice of Bambi?
During the Marine Corps? No chance. I never said a word to anybody about Bambi. Even to you, when we first met, I never said a word about it. Most of the image in people's minds of Bambi was a little frail deer, not doing very well, sliding around on the ice on his belly.
Mother, look! What's all that white stuff?
It's snow.
Snow?
I am a commander in Marine Corps boot camp, drill instructors, hundreds of recruits I'm responsible for. I just thought to myself, I don't think I want all these young Marines to start calling me Major Bambi, and I kept my mouth shut.
When did your comrades find out?
One Marine learned about it a month before we both retired. I worked for him three times, twice in combat, and I'm one of his guys. A major audit was going on the base. I am up to my neck in duties. He called me in at 5:30 in the morning. I will never forget. I go in his office and he says, Dunnigan, I want you to audit the auditors. I had never said a disrespectful word to this man in 20 years. So I said, General, when do you think I am going to have time to do that? Then he looked at me, pulled his glasses down like some kind of college professor, and there's a big red top secret folder that he got out of some safe somewhere, had my name on it. He pats this folder, looks me in the eye, and says, you will audit the auditors, won't you, Major Bambi?
So how has your life been different than you imagined it would be?
Oh, golly. Well, I have some holes in my body that God didn't put there. I got shot through my left knee. I got an award or two for saving lives over time. But I think I could have been appointed as the aide-de-camp in the White House. It wouldn't make any difference. It's Bambi that's so dear to people. But I love it now when people realize this old jerk is still alive and was Bambi. And I wouldn't take anything for it. Not a darn thing for it.
Retired Marine and voice of Bambi, Donnie Dunnigan, with his wife Dana at the StoryCorps in San Angelo, Texas. Their story will be archived at the Library of Congress.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. At a tournament in Germany next month, one of the world's largest electronic sports organizations is giving players a shot at $250,000 in prize money, along with the possibility of a drug test. For the first time, the Electronic Sports League, or ESL, is partnering with the anti-doping authorities who test athletes in more traditional sports like cycling or soccer to crack down on brain-boosting drugs in an industry that attracts more than 113 million fans worldwide. Nick Wingfield is a reporter for the New York Times and recently co-wrote an article about it called Drug Testing is Coming to Esports. Nick, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So which drugs are they going to be testing for?
Well, the main focus is going to be on amphetamines, of which Adderall is one. But there are other drugs as well that will eventually be on the test. But initially, that's what they're going to be focusing on. Adderall being kind of an attention-focusing drug that's prescribed for ADHD. And there's speculation that it might actually help competitive gamers, although we don't know that for sure.
Right. We know that college students are famously taking them for studying and testing. How are they going to be testing for this? Blood tests, urine tests?
It was a skin test initially that they're going to be doing, but they haven't been really specific about all of the details of the testing regimen. It will be random, though, so not everyone will be tested.
So why now? What is driving this decision to randomly test players now?
We're at a really interesting moment for competitive video gaming, which is called esports. It's gotten quite big. You have corporate sponsors that are coming into it, like Coca-Cola. You have media partnerships. ESPN has broadcast it. There are a lot of online broadcasting partners. And the leagues and companies that are involved in esports are becoming much more concerned about legitimacy. So they don't want there to be any perception that someone has an unfair advantage or is cheating in order to win a match, because there's a lot of money on the line in some of these competitions, and they want to, you know, they want to make sure that this field continues to grow.
Yeah, I'm reading prize money alone expected to reach $71 million industry-wide. And of course, as you mentioned, all these sponsorships, sponsoring individual athletes and players?
That's right. There are different models all over the place. You know, in Korea, for example, there are telecommunications companies that have sponsored teams. In the United States, often there are privately owned teams that that have players, but they do have sponsors as well. And the prize money has just gotten huge. I'm in Seattle, and this very week, there's a tournament for the game Dota 2 with the largest esports prize pool ever, $18 million.
Wow. Well, one of the players, Corey Friesen, he spoke specifically about taking Adderall to help him with his concentration. But what if players are legitimately diagnosed and prescribed Adderall or Ritalin for ADHD?
That's right. I mean, I don't know what exactly what the policies are going to be, how much will be allowed. I believe that's that other sports have also kind of developed policies around legitimate uses of some of these drugs. You know, this is a fairly new policy that the ESL has put in place. So we're going to have to wait to see what some of the details are about, you know, legitimate uses of some of these drugs.
How are players reacting to the possibility of a random drug test?
I think for the most part, they're relatively positive about it. You know, it's really not clear how widespread the use of Adderall was. It's been whispered about, but it's not actually that clear also whether it gives you much of an advantage. The player that you mentioned earlier actually ended up not winning. His team ended up not winning. So it clearly didn't give him a leg up in that particular case. But I think overall players really want to see this whole area develop, and they don't want to see anything taint the field of esports.
Yeah, so in this attempt at legitimacy, what effect do you think it's going to have? Will people be more accepting or think differently about competitive electronic gaming?
You know, I don't think the any perception that there has been doping in esports has harmed the growth of it yet. It's really been kind of underground up until this point. I think really esports faces other challenges to its growth, which is just making it more comprehensible and accessible to a wider audience. That's really what's going to affect the perception of it. And that's partly going to be a generational shift. You know, as kind of today's esports fans, people in their kind of 18 to 30 year old, you know, get older, and their children come up playing video games and seeing esports as kind of a normal thing. I think we're going to see this field grow very significantly at that stage.
Nick Wingfield, thank you for speaking with us.
You bet.
Nick Wingfield is a reporter for the New York Times. You can find a link to read the article that he co-wrote, Drug Testing is Coming to Esports. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. It's taken decades and a massive shift in gaming demographics to make clear that video games are not just for kids. Recently, millions of adults have been buying another item that was once thought of as for children only. Coloring books. It's all part of a larger trend of products and experiences, from footsie pajamas to summer camp, that cater to grown-ups who long to get back in touch with their childhood experiences. In Brooklyn, adults can even attend preschool, where they make crafts with glitter glue and have nap time. Call it regression or therapy, Adrian Raffel wrote about what is being called the Peter Pan market for the New Yorker magazine. And Adrian, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what are some of the best-selling adult coloring books now?
Well, one of them is by, well, two of them are by this Scottish artist named Joanna Basford, and her first book was called Secret Garden, an inky treasure hunt and coloring book. Inky treasure, I love that. And then her second one was Enchanted Forest, an inky quest, and she draws them by hand in her studio in Scotland, and they just completely took off.
They're beautiful books. I went and looked at her website, and when I started looking into them, I found that people that I know love these coloring books. I was a little shocked.
You know, it's funny. I was talking about this the other day to a friend of mine who's in the same PhD program as I am, and she said, oh, yeah, I used those coloring books when I was, you know, working on, stressed out about final papers. My friend gave me Joanna Basford's books, and I just, like, they worked.
Well, what do you think is behind their popularity, and how popular are they, by the way?
Well, so Joanna Basford's books aren't the only ones out there. There's a Creative Haven series by Dover. There's lots of these books in England and in France. But to give you an example, this spring, Joanna Basford's Secret Garden and Enchanted Forest were sold out on Amazon for weeks, and they were just like the two best-selling books, and you couldn't get them. I mean, you couldn't get them on Amazon for weeks.
So that's pretty significant. But well, why do you think people are gravitating towards coloring books for adults?
There's a sort of combination of things. I think there's this soothing effect of them, and they can both like sort of be as artistic as possible, but also there's zero pressure. And there's something about these books that is neither childlike, like you don't feel like you're sort of coloring in an outline of a character from a TV show or of like a little bunny or a bow or something, but also, you know, they're really sophisticated, intricate designs. They sort of put you into I mean, this is what proponents of them and people I've talked to who love them say. They put you into this kind of meditative, focused space that you just don't get in the rest of everyday life, especially sort of staring at screens all the time.
Hmm. What are some of the other components of this Peter Pan market that you write about?
So one of the ones that I really loved looking into is Michelle Joni, this woman in Brooklyn who started an adult preschool camp where adults go and they like live by a superhero name while they're in preschool, and they have nap time and they have glitter and they have, you know, school pictures, and they have all the things that are like sort of form the components of your first memories, but you're doing them as you're 30 or 40 or whatever years old instead of when you're four. And, you know, it seems kind of ridiculous at first.
To the people who are putting on this camp, I mean, is there any sense of irony about it? Or they, I mean, what are they trying to do exactly?
So I think that it's a combination of this sort of like, of a sense of like irony, almost beyond irony, like no one could possibly take this seriously. So why not just go as completely ridiculous as possible and like go with the sort of, I think it's the idea that like if you sort of let loose and go with kind of this like crazily ridiculous idea in your spare time, you know, maybe that'll kind of loosen you up in the rest of your life so you can enjoy everything that you do and kind of have a little bit more spark and just kind of your daily proceedings.
It seems like there's a lot of nostalgia here, and I'm wondering, just because I'm reading another book right now about hovering parents and, you know, the damage that the helicopter parent can do, is this kind of idea that millennials or the generation of adults now wish to be protected? I'm not sure what's behind it.
So some of the people I did speak to, some experts I spoke to, who were a little bit more maybe skeptical or incredulous of the progression of this trend, did worry that, you know, is this kind of a regression for millennials? Is this some sort of reaching back to a safer place, as you say, because of the both the kind of the competitive pressures growing up and then the, like, pressures that you're facing, you know, like it sort of parallels a trend of 20-somethings moving back into their parents' houses mm-hmm. for very serious economic reasons. And then there's sort of maybe the darker flip side of all this kind of cheery glitter glue is this because we're having this kind of economically forced second childhood is one of the theories going around. And you know, I wonder about that. I wonder, is that behind some of this really kind of almost aggressive like reclaiming of the childhood that one perhaps never had?
But you also write that this is not the first time that recessions give rise to these kind of, I don't know, let's say recess-like activities.
Yeah. It's funny, in a recession, you know, in the 80s during the recession, the hula hoop, which was big in the 50s, all of a sudden came back into prominence. They were remarketing the hula hoop as, like, de-stress by, you know, getting back to your inner child. So as much as, you know, people are sort of worrying maybe or questioning the inner child coming out now, this has been a thing that has persisted for generations and generations back.
Do you think this trend of the adult coloring books and YA literature we can include in that, you know, mm-hmm. summer camps for kids, preschool for kids, is it something that's going to stick around or will it just rotate like the hula hoop? I'm sorry.
You know, no, I like that. You know, I feel like the general structure of the trend is going to stick around. What's sort of on the table, be it hula hoops or coloring books or silly putty or, you know, toy archery things, you know, what people are using to express their inner child is definitely, I feel like, will probably end up rotating.
Well, Adrienne, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Adrienne Raffel, she is contributing writer for The New Yorker, and that's where we found her article, Why Adults Are Buying Coloring Books for Themselves. And you'll find a link to read it yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. Whether you're indulging your inner child or looking for something more grown up to listen to, word of mouth has it all. And you can listen anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You'll find a link at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And don't forget to pass it along or play it for a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.